Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Historian Henry Winsett kicked Thomas Jefferson's backside last year with a searing look at the third president and slavery. Winsett's book, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves, painted Jefferson as a master hypocrite for opposing slavery during the writing of the Declaration of Independence, but then later supporting it at his own home when it suited his financial needs. Henry Winsett will be in town tomorrow to talk about one of his earlier books on George Washington that examines Washington's views of slavery. It's a far more benevolent view, and the author joins us in just a moment. Later on this hour, is the need to give blood on the wane? We'll find out. But first up, Henry Winsett and his book on George Washington, An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. Henry Winsett joins us this morning from his home in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Henry, so nice to have you again. Welcome back to Up to Date.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, you begin your book on Washington with such an interesting story about a dream that Washington had late in his life at Mount Vernon. It was a dream that had made him uncharacteristically sad. What was the dream?
He had a premonition in a dream that that he was going to die rather soon. He was someone who had earlier worried about his impending death when he was in office. He mistakenly thought that that he had cancer, as a result, at that time he wrote a will, but it turned out he didn't have skin cancer as he feared, and you know everything was fine. But when he had this second premonition in the summer of 1799, he took it very, very seriously and began to write his will. And in the second clause of that will, he wrote a very, very long section about freeing his slaves.
And what's so interesting about that section, Henry, was just how adamant George Washington was about what he wanted to see happen when it came to his own slaves. What did he say? How strongly did he feel about it?
Well, that's the language of that clause really struck me. That document is not something that a lot of historians have read closely. It's just seen as 20-something pages of boilerplate where he gives away this money to here and that money to there and states some wishes. But I really wanted to read the language closely. And what struck me after reading the whole document a couple of times was how ferocious the language of the slavery clause was. It really stood out for its vehemence. He said that he was freeing his slaves, and he said that this. The emancipation of his slaves should take place without evasion, neglect, or delay, and that the clause should be religiously obeyed. You can almost, hear him pounding the table as he reads this aloud to his relatives. And wills are written for relatives. These were his own family members. And that led me to think that Washington expected that his relatives would try to find some way to wiggle out of this. And he wanted to make it absolutely clear that this was his firm, fixed, ironclad intention that these people should be freed, they should be trained, and taken care of.
Were his wishes ultimately acted upon in the way he wanted?
Yes, they were. In fact, the emancipation of his slaves took place a little bit earlier than he had planned. Because he had said that the slaves would remain slaves until his wife Martha died. He did not want to disrupt her life. I mean, she was an elderly woman, and he was extremely concerned for her welfare. But Martha, after George died, Martha apparently became nervous because the slaves were to be freed when she died, and she hoped that the slaves would not do something to hasten that moment. So, the story that comes down is that, and it's not just a story, there was, in fact, a small fire at Mount Vernon, and I guess there was some chatter in the family that, well, maybe a slave set it to burn down the house with Martha in it. I mean, there's no evidence for that, but there's certainly very strong evidence that Martha got very nervous and that it was decided to push up the manumission of the slaves for, quote, prudential reasons. And so they were freed while Martha was still alive on January 1st, 1800.
We're visiting with historian Henry Winsick about his book on George Washington that looks at Washington's views towards slavery. Hey, how many slaves are we talking about that George Washington owned in those days, Henry?
He owned in his own name 123 slaves. There were altogether over 300 slaves at Mount Vernon around the time of his death. But
why the disparity?
Well, because the remainder of those slaves, the 40 of those slaves were rented from someone else, but the remainder of that were owned by Martha's heirs. They were the so-called dower slaves. She had been married to a very, very wealthy planter, landowner, and slave owner, Daniel Park Custis, who died in 1759 without a will, and leaving Martha with two small children. So all of his land and slaves went to his son, Jack Custis. The daughter didn't inherit any of the so-called real property. That was in keeping with the law of the time. It had to go to the oldest male. And so Jackie got all of the land and slaves, but under the law, Martha had the life use of one-third of the income from all of that, with that land and all of those slaves,
mm-hmm.
without the ownership. Now, that income was very large, and it enabled George Washington to renovate Mount Vernon and to live in a... I don't know how many of your viewers are following Downton Abbey, but or your listeners are following Downton Abbey.
A ton.
But this is like the outside infusion of cash that saves the estate.
Mm-hmm.
Because George... Mount Vernon, the Mount Vernon estate was floundering. George was in debt, and so he sought out this wealthy widow and married her. And then that infusion of cash really kept him going. And that was a yearly flow of cash from these farms.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what enabled George Washington to devote so much time to public service in the Continental Congress, in the Army, and then as president.
You know, this number of slaves that he had, Henry, was that an unusually high number, medium, compared to other landowners in the Virginia area?
I think that he was the biggest slave owner in Fairfax County. I mean, that was a large holding.
Right.
It wasn't immense, but it was a large holding. Offhand, I can't... Well, for some, by comparison, at that time, George Thomas Jefferson probably had about 110 slaves on his plantation at Monticello.
Right. Right.
The Washingtons had over 300. So, I mean, the combined holdings of Washington, George Washington, and the Custis family were, you know, rather much larger than Jefferson.
Right. Well, let's go back to this decision that Washington makes to free his slaves in his will, because, Henry, we really can't emphasize this enough. This was an extraordinary decision. He was the only founding father who would set his slaves free. How do you characterize it? Just what a significant moment was this in our history with George Washington declaring that his slaves would be free?
Oh, the extraordinary is the word. There were other people doing that at that time, but none of George Washington's prominence. And there was one other slaveholder, Robert Carter, who was also from Virginia, who freed more slaves. That was slightly later, and he did it with a gradual emancipation that was very, very well planned, well thought out, well financed. But George Washington did it all at once. And it's very interesting because some people have misread the opening of my book, and they think that when George Washington had this dream, and it was the dream that made him decide to free his slaves.
Right.
But
right.
I make it very clear in the opening pages that it was the dream that made him write his will, but he had been struggling for about 10 years to find a way to free his slaves.
So how does he arrive at this point, Henry, this decision point where he decides to free his slaves? What is the process he went through, and how did he wind up there?
George Washington was a man of with a very, very powerful sense of justice. Jefferson said that about him. He, after Washington's death, he said that Washington's sense of justice was the most inflexible that he had ever known. And right before Washington assumed the presidency, he talked about emancipating his slaves and said that such an act would be in keeping with the justice of the Creator. So he was looking to, you know, a higher power, and he was thinking morally and thinking ethically.
But he didn't do it at that point, though, right?
No, he didn't. And that note that I just referred to was in the notebook of his private secretary, who was then preparing drafts of speeches that Washington would make upon assuming the presidency. And my interpretation is that Washington at one point decided to announce that he had freed his slaves before assuming the office, which would have been a tremendously powerful event.
I was going to say, what impact would that have had?
Well, everything Washington did set a precedent. So it would have set the precedent that a sitting president does not hold slaves. And what would Jefferson have done? What would Madison have done? What would Monroe have done? What would Jackson have done? And, you know, going on down the line. He didn't do it. And he always had the unity of the nation in mind. But he grew to dislike slavery so much that he tried twice during his presidency while in office to find ways to free his own slaves. And I argue that he was trying to use his own example, his personal example at Mount Vernon, to set a precedent for others and to set an example and to get this emancipation process moving, because the political process was stagnating, that the slaveholders had too many votes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never going to, an emancipation plan would never get through Congress, and it would never get through any southern state as far as Washington could see. But my interpretation is that he wanted to use his personal prestige to push this forward.
How difficult would it have been for him to have freed his slaves during his years in the White House? Or I guess in those days it wasn't the White House, was it? Whatever
it was in those days. He was in Philadelphia. He actually never even laid eyes on the White House.
Mm-hmm.
The first plan that he had foundered because he couldn't get the financing together. He wanted to sell some of the Western lands that he had gotten as a reward for his service in the French and Indian War. And he couldn't find any buyers. The real estate market was in a trough. Later, in 1795 and 96, he wanted to free not only his own slaves, but all of the so-called dower slaves, which were then in the hands of Martha's grandson-in-law, a doctor named David Stewart. And he approached Stewart, wrote him a letter that he marked private. He didn't want anyone to know about this. And said, look, I have a plan. I want to free all of my slaves, but I don't want to do this and break up the families. A lot of my people are married to people that you own. Let's get together and do this. And the very interesting part is he had figured out how to solve the labor problem. Most people say, well, they couldn't free their slaves because then they wouldn't have any labor.
Mm-hmm.
Washington wrote in this letter, let's set them free, and then we'll hire them right back, either as sharecroppers or on cash wages. We'll work out the details later, but let's do this. And David Stewart wrote back to him and said, no, I'm not interested. My own finances are somewhat in a poor shape right now. Underneath that was Stewart's reluctance to give up the asset value of
mm-hmm.
those plans.
Mm-hmm. Again, we're visiting this morning with Henry Winsick, the historian, about his book, George Washington, An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. He'll be speaking at 6:30, weather permitting, Wednesday night at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the Plaza. It's part of the Hail to the Chief series the library is sponsoring with the help of UpToDate and KCUR. More information about that event, kclibrary.org. Well, if you want to join our conversation, too, you're welcome to do so. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, as you're talking about Washington and his maneuvers sort of behind the scenes when it came to his own slaves, Henry, I'm very cognizant of a point that you make in this book about just how difficult a man George Washington was to read. In fact, you call him notoriously difficult to understand, notoriously difficult to read. Tell us about that aspect of George Washington.
Well, on the subject of slavery, he made a number of seemingly conflicting statements in his life and conflicting acts. But what I did in the book and also in my Jefferson book is I put everything on a timeline, and then things begin to get clearer.
Mm-hmm.
Both Washington and Jefferson went through processes and a series of transformations on the subject of slavery. I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, they both lived very long lives, and circumstances changed, their own thinking changed. And I think that many people who have written about Washington have tended to pluck quotations from different parts of Washington's life and say, well, he was conflicted, he was contradictory on this subject. But when you lay it out on a timeline, you really do see a clear pattern. And by the last 10 years of his life, he had a fixed intention of freeing his slaves and was prevented from doing it really by the resistance of his family until in his last will. He was also very worried about the political effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned a minute ago, he was trying to get this private secret plan going with the custody heirs, and he wrote in the letter that he was concerned about the political implications. He knew that it would cause trouble, but yet he still wanted to go ahead. And I think that, as Humphrey Bogart once said in a movie, I don't mind a reasonable amount of trouble. And that I believe that he thought this would get things moving. Another independent historian, Charles Rapley, who wrote a fascinating book about the Brown Brothers of Providence, turned up some information about Washington that had escaped me. In 1792, a group of Quakers presented a petition to Congress to try to force Congress to begin considering emancipation. Rapley found out that George Washington was behind that plan, that he helped the Quakers to get it submitted. So he was trying to work independently, but he was also trying to work through the political process. When that plan was presented, James Madison helped to scuttle it.
You know, Henry, you talk about him being difficult to read on slavery, but he's also just sort of, there's an inscrutable quality about George Washington. And on this score, you tell a great story about what Abigail Adams once said about him, and yet another story about Washington once entering a room full of his step-granddaughter's friends and how they reacted to the arrival of the great George Washington. Tell us that story.
Yes, Abigail Adams left a great quote. I mean, I think that she had some sexual attraction to him because when she first saw him, she wrote to someone saying, "The half has never been told me." He was such an imposing figure, and he was famously attractive to the ladies. And Abigail Adams described seeing him walking down the street in New York, and she said that he looked as awful as a god. He had that same effect on his own family, and there was a story about how, as you describe, he walked into a room full of his granddaughter's friends at a social event, and everybody immediately fell silent because, what do you say? What do you say in
it's
front
the
of
man.
George Washington?
The man has arrived, yeah.
Right, the great man has arrived. And the story is, you know, he sat down, he realized that he had thrown cold water over the whole event, this grumpy expression came over his face, and he walked out. But it was a reputation that he really didn't deserve, because a Polish nobleman who visited Mount Vernon and stayed there for 10 days, Count Julian Niemcewicz, said that Washington was very affable, that he didn't like to talk politics because he didn't like to gossip in ways that might hurt people or hurt the political process. But if you got him talking about farming or even about the war, he would discourse very pleasantly. And they sat around and drank Madeira for hours and had a fine old time.
Let's go to some phone calls here for Henry Winsek and our topic today, George Washington and his slaves. David from Kingsville, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I should predicate everything by saying I've really only read one biography of George Washington, which was Ron Chernow's biography. But in that book, Chernow makes the point, which I think shows how complicated a character Washington actually was, that Washington had become disillusioned with slaves as a workforce. He freed them in part because of the economics. He viewed them, I guess, the way you could view a mule or a horse.
Mm-hmm.
which was you had to feed them even when they weren't out in the fields working. And of course, he was concerned about the growth in the slave population on his plantation. So, be interesting to hear what your author has to say about that.
Great points, David. Thank you. Go ahead, Henry.
I have a great. I really love Chernow's book on Washington, and he gets some of his information about slavery from my book. I don't think that's exactly right. I mean, there were Joseph Ellis is another one who has said that Washington was essentially running a retirement village for the for old slaves and a daycare center for young slaves.
Hmm.
But the more that we learn about slavery, the more we realize that everybody in the enslaved community worked in one way or another, unless they were very severely disabled. And it is true that Washington said that he had more workers on his plantation than he actually needed. But the I don't think that he had a very dim view. Let me back that up a bit. Washington could be very harsh in speaking about both whites and blacks. For example, he was reluctant to buy a new threshing machine because he said that on his plantation, anything complicated would have the lifespan of a mushroom, because neither his white overseers nor his black workers could figure out how to run such a thing.
Mm.
There are also some very funny letters where he talks about the ways that some of the slaves had for evading work. He said that that his carts seemed to go off and sleep. But but Washington never said anything racially derogatory about black people. That's the interesting thing. He also mentioned how some of his white workers stole from him.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably true that Mount Vernon had more workers than it needed, but Washington would not sell them, and he was concerned that if he just handed over all of these slaves to his heirs, that they would sell the excess, and he was absolutely opposed to the selling of people.
Let's go to Harry from Leawood. Harry, good morning. Our topic today, George Washington and his slaves. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning. I'd like to make a comment. I was listening to the author justify or explain why Washington did not want to have to support slavery, and he, in fact, did not get rid of his slaves when his wife was an old lady because he didn't want to disrupt things at that time. This borders on being gross insincerity to me. Being a man of means, he could have hired a nurse if he wanted to. I don't think Washington actually ever wanted to get rid of slaves, and I think that he was as bad as Jefferson in that respect. And so, and I don't think that the argument that the author's putting forth makes Washington any better than Jefferson. It just shows that he was as bad as Jefferson.
Hmm.
That's my opinion.
Harry, I appreciate comments. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a reasonable opinion. I too wish that Washington had pushed harder on some of his earlier plans. In his defense, I have a theory, and I may have mentioned it in the book. I don't think I know I didn't develop it very much. I have a sense that Washington believes that in 1808. When the slave trade was scheduled to come to an end, that he believed that that would be the beginning of an emancipation process, and that that it was Washington's belief that slavery was actually not going to last all that long. And so he may not have felt a great sense of urgency, but I share Harry's disappointment at what Washington didn't do, and I do wish that he had done more. I think that it's I don't agree with calling him hypocritical, but I can understand how one would want to put that put that adjective to it.
You know, I wanted to get to a couple of points you make in this book, Henry, because it's such an interesting book, and you've written it so well. You know, you've walked the grounds at Mount Vernon many times, and I'm wondering, what do you learn about George Washington's home and his plantation when it comes to slavery from taking those walks? And describe the slave quarters for us, if you would, because that was so interesting to me.
Well, the one thing you come away with is the grandeur of the place.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, slave labor, despite all the complaints of slave owners, including George Washington, that at times slave labor could be unprofitable and it was difficult to get them to work, these people lived very, very grandly. There's no question about that. Many of the slave quarters have completely disappeared. George Washington had five farms. And on the four outlying farms, all the slave cabins have disappeared. And Washington said that that they were very, very poor, and that in one case a strong wind would knock over one house. And he referred to them in one letter as just coverings, and said that a white person would not live in them. But for his privileged household slaves, the artisans, he built a rather snug slave barracks, which still stands right in front of the mansion, and we don't know exactly what the interior looked like. He said that the people would sleep in berths, and these were all men who lived there. This is one unfortunate characteristic of Washington's slave management, is that he routinely separated husbands and wives. He kept the highly skilled men right close to the mansion house, and their wives and children lived on outlying farms where they did the hard work of the fields.
Well, there's a story, a lot of folks know it, about Thomas Jefferson and his relations with Sally Hemings. People tend to forget that a similar story lingers in Washington's background as well, Henry. Tell us that.
Yes, for many, many years there have been reports in the African-American press, and there were oral histories in an African-American family that stated that George Washington had a child with a slave woman named Venus, who was owned by his brother. And his brother lived, John Augustine Washington, his brother lived 90 miles away at a plantation on the northern neck of Virginia, also near the Potomac. So geographically, it would have been very difficult for George and Venus to get together. But in my research, I uncovered a document which showed that, in fact, for a series of days, maybe a week or a week and a half, this woman named Venus would have been at Mount Vernon when George Washington was there and Martha Washington was very sick and bedridden. So the opportunity presented itself for George to have become the father of this young slave who had the name West Ford. Ford was his last name. However, I think that's unlikely, and I go into the reasons in the book. I think it is more likely that West Ford was the son of one of John Augustine's sons, and it could have been Bushrod, but more likely another son. And after George Washington died, Bushrod Washington inherited Mount Vernon, and he brought West Ford with him, made him the manager of a manager at Mount Vernon, and in his will, Bushrod left West Ford a large chunk of land adjacent to Mount Vernon.
So you don't buy the idea that George Washington was West Ford's father?
I don't. It is within the realm of possibility. But I do not buy that idea.
We could have one more phone call here before we leave this conversation. Tom from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning. You there, Tom? Let's go to Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, good morning.
Good morning. Very good conversation. I'd like to say that many black historians have, some mixed views of George Washington, but they also hold up his last will and testimony of freeing a slave is one of the most important documents in the history of African-American history. And it's also my understanding that Prince Hall, the gentleman who founded, the Masonic, Black Masonic Masons,
right,
spoke at his funeral. Now, I don't know if that's correct or not.
I have never heard that. I did not know that. But you see, not being a Mason, I don't know what kind of Masonic ceremonies might have taken place. But that's a very interesting idea. To go back to the will for a minute, it is a very important document because Washington reveals in there his racial thinking. He says that the young people, those under age 25, should be bound out to farmers and tradesmen to learn trades. They should be taught to read and write, and under no circumstance should they be sent out of the state or out of the country. So Washington, unlike Jefferson and other people of the time, thought that black people were, you know, mentally on a par with whites, that they were amenable to training and education, that they could certainly learn to read and write, mm-hmm. and deserved to and needed to, and that they had a place in Virginia as free citizens. You know, Jefferson was calling for the mass deportation of black people. Washington called for the opposite. He said, no, these people have a right to live here. They have a right to be Americans as free people.
Such interesting stuff, Henry. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. And I should point out that Henry Winsek will be speaking at 6:30 Wednesday night at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the Plaza. It's part of the Hail to the Chief series the library is sponsoring with the help of UpToDate and KCUR. More information, kclibrary.org. Henry, it's always good to have you here. Thanks for taking time with us again.
Thank you, Steve. I enjoyed it.
That's Henry Winsek. His book again, An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America.